This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. UW System President Ray Cross has been on the job since earlier this year, but this month he's entering his first new academic school year. As the university system goes through a number of changes and faces a variety of challenges, we'll talk with President Cross about the state of Wisconsin's colleges and universities and the direction he hopes to take them in. So I'm wondering, you're entering your first fall semester. You've been on the job for about 6-7 months. How have things been going so far?
Well, they've been very busy. In fact, it seems like I've already been on the job a couple of years, but probably to a lot of other people as well. I think we're making some progress. I really do in a number of key areas, but all of that's yet to be determined. These jobs are challenging at best, and the state's facing some difficult issues, and the universities interwoven into those issues. So together we're trying to work on those issues that are important to all of us.
So I want to talk about a number of topics that you brought up to the Board of Regents recently, last month. You addressed the regents and you talked about a transformed UW system that will have a statewide vision and be more future-oriented. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that vision that you have for the system.
I'll try, and I'll try not to get too wordy in this process, Maureen. Systems were originally created to manage and control university growth. States created them during a period of just unbelievable enrollment growth, beginning after World War II. And then in that process, systems were established and became good at bureaucratic processes. And I mean that in a positive way. They were designed to mechanically control things. They weren't really designed to be statewide leaders, although some of that happened, but they were principally created to control, distribute resources, to manage things, not to lead. So because of that, they at this point need to change, and we need to collectively work together in order to have an impact on the kinds of challenges facing the state and not be independent, isolated entities functioning separate from one another, perhaps even doing different things that are at odds with what the state needs. So that system-wide vision as to what we should be doing has to be linked to the needs of the state. The state's needs have to play a bigger role in what the system's purpose should be all about.
So do you see a place for the university system to become more of a leader in the state? Because it seems like there are probably some people who would say that universities and the different people working in them are leaders in their in many different ways.
Oh, I would think that that's probably more true for the campuses, the institutional campuses in their region. Most certainly, they're more flexible. They demonstrate more of a vision for leadership within their regions. Can we aggregate that in a collective way to have an impact on the state's needs? I would also argue that I most definitely can see this in a positive way for the University of Wisconsin, in part because our size allows us – we're not as big as a State University of New York or California, so it's easier to communicate and effectively implement that kind of a vision. But I think it's important that the university be the resource for establishing these are the needs of the state tomorrow and the year after that and the year after that. At this point, we have a lot of folks, most often politicians, saying this is what the state needs. This is what we need. And their background may be or may not be adequately prepared to make those kinds of judgments. We need to use data to inform that, and we need to be saying to leaders in the state, this is where the state's employment needs are going to be 10 years from now. Help us get there. We need to be telling them that in a few years we will need PhDs in data science, those kinds of things.
Beyond job projections, are there other forms of data that you think the university could provide for the state in helping maybe shape the path that it takes?
I think so. It used to be that the university was leaned on more often to provide background and information about things. And extension often is particularly within its region or locally.
Especially with agriculture
especially
data.
Especially with agriculture. And with natural resources and things like that. But I think there's a lot of room for that kind of engagement. Having the university do research and analyze things in collaboration with the legislature or with the agencies within state agencies. I would also point out that I really think that we need to get to craft a vision for where we want the state to be. Increasingly, the state's future and its future success and ours is linked to the new economy. And that new economy is going to be driven by talent and ideas. Clearly, those are the drivers. The university is the hotbed for both of those, period. And we have to help the state understand that, and they have to help us get in a position to better serve them.
So in developing this plan for the future, do you have your own ideas that you've been working out, or who will you be reaching out to kind of help craft what this vision may be?
Well, one of the reasons I'm in La Crosse is to sit down with business leaders tomorrow morning. How might the university more effectively serve you? Where do you see the needs of the state in the future? So part of this is a listening tour around the state. I have a broad picture here. Well, we need to be doing more to serve the state. That's pretty broad. Refining that into what that means and how it's effectively implemented is going to take a lot more work than just some dream or vision of Ray Cross.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with UW System President Ray Cross. Another idea that you brought up to the Board of Regents recently was calling on universities to step up their efforts when it comes to working with college students who need remedial coursework. And you had said you want to reduce the number of students who require basic math courses, maybe as they enter as a freshman, and make sure more students who need remedial coursework actually finish that coursework in a timely manner. Why is this an issue that you've really honed in on?
Right now in the state of Wisconsin, there are somewhere between 150,000 and 170,000 job openings. Those are different, and we're not trying to use strict economic terms here. Those are different than job vacancies, et cetera. However, let's assume for a minute that we could put someone in every one of those jobs. Where would this economy be, and why is that important? Right now, the economy is growing and has grown at about a 3.3% rate, that is Wisconsin's economy, on average over the last decade, 3.3% a year. By the time you withdraw inflation from that, we're down to 1 to 1.5%. It has little to do with politics. It has more to do with the workforce. We are in an era of declining high school graduates. In fact, it's about another 4 or 5 years before that jumps up slightly. So we have fewer high school graduates. We have an outmigration of working age adults. Those people between the ages of 20, 22, and 45 are leaving the state to the tune of about 10 to 14,000 a year. Now, it's not fair to look at that number alone because many of those return when they're older. So the total migration is not as severe as it sounds, but the critical part is that working age adult. And then the third part, the whole state is getting older. So on average, there are counties in this state where the average age is already over 60. We need working age adults, and they need to be equipped with the tools to participate in the new economy. Those three demographic factors are our destiny. So we don't have a choice. Unless some miracle happens, we have to get more of the students we have through our education system and prepare them to participate in the new economy. We have to do that. That's why remedial is so important. We have to do a better job of that.
Do you think that, I mean, because some may hear that and think, well, shouldn't that be up to high schools or even kindergarten through eighth grade? Why the university?
I think it is up to high schools, but I would argue that it's too easy for the university to say that's their problem. It's always someone else's problem. We want to own that too. We want to say, well, we produce the teachers for that system. What do we set the standards? What is college readiness at this point? It's we communicate that in so many different ways. High school faculty don't, they probably look at that and say, well, this institution wants this, this institution wants that. Can't they agree upon something? Yeah, that's what we have to do. I think being clearer about our expectations and then working much more closely with K-12 faculty in math, that's our focus initially, helping to clearly establish our standards and articulate those effectively. Is an important part of the problem. We believe, and I've set a goal of reducing that need from 21% to 14% over the next 5 years. And I really think we can do that just by being clear and holding those standards, working with an early math placement test, et cetera. I'm right here in La Crosse. The MOOC has been the math MOOC, I think, has a lot of potential.
Which is the online math course.
Which is the online math course. Yeah, it's excellent.
Are there other institutions you've looked towards? You mentioned UW-La Crosse and the math readiness course that it provides online. Are there other universities that you think are handling this situation correctly?
There are probably, well, correctly.
Correctly might not be the right word.
Yeah, we're all trying to. There are other institutions, several of them within the UW system, that are doing things that are different, and they appear to be successful. All of those are things we're looking at. There are three or four of them right off the top of my head that I would mention. UW Colleges has some of that going on. Parkside has some of that going on. Milwaukee has some of that. I also know that Oshkosh, I could go on.
Sure.
They're all experimenting with a little different thing. I'm not sure we're sharing the successes or effectively critiquing it to determine what are the key factors in that. But that's what we're trying to work on.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, I'm talking with UW System President Ray Cross. So I want to talk about higher education and affordability. People have been calling on finding solutions to make higher education more affordable. Is this anything that is a priority for the UW system? And is the system looking towards finding solutions and making higher education more affordable?
Absolutely. I almost want to enthusiastically jump through the microphone here. I think we've always been interested in trying to make things affordable. I do believe that we have to be much more diligent about action that considers the price to students, and not just in the classroom, whether it's in the cafeteria, it's in the residence halls, or in other activities. It has to be throughout. Now, tuition is frozen for the next couple of years.
And that was decided this June. The Board of Regents approved that decision.
Yeah. Well, they'll have to approve it again next June because it's approved on an annual basis, but the commitment is there. However, that's only a piece of it. We have to find ways to increase the compensation of our faculty when you compare them elsewhere. It's something that a lot of folks throughout the state may not recognize. It. Faculty, for the most part, compete in a national market, particularly the good ones. And when someone can come in and offer them a 25% to 30% raise and a number of new amenities, why you begin to think, well, how can we compete? Some of those are going to happen anyway. I understand that. But we have to find ways to make sure we are retaining and attracting quality faculty. If we don't do that on a consistent basis, then we're in a downhill decline. And right now we're somewhere between, depending on rank and time and tenure, we're somewhere between 13% and 18% in most ranks, faculty ranks. We're somewhere behind their clearly established peer institution salary ranges. Now, when I put those two together, you're freezing tuition. You're trying to hold costs down over here. Your state revenues are down. How, Ray, do you intend to deal with some of that? I don't know. But that's part of the challenge in that I really think we have to find ways to save money in the non-instructional side, the backroom operations, if you will, those things that aren't directly interfacing with students, to shift resources more heavily over to the instruction side.
What do you mean more by backroom?
Well, IT, computer operations, things that tend to be, in the business world, back office stuff. Mm-hmm. Can we find more efficient ways to do that? And when you talked about a statewide vision, the second piece of that is a strategic management process, leveraging our systemness, if you will, to the advantage of individual institutions by consolidating operations that they each may have backroom operations that and we'll never get rid of all that, but I mean, how do you consolidate some of that in ways to shift those resources over to the academic side of the organization? That's just one possibility. Collaboration, much more collaboration. The whole world is moving in that direction, and we have to as well. If we hope to take some of the limited resources we have and realign them with our strategic directions.
And I know none of this is set in stone, but as you say consolidation, I'm sure some people may think red flag, that might mean jobs lost.
And not necessarily, because what it does mean is that there may be other things. A normal job attrition in a university like this where, I don't know, you got 40-some thousand employees or more than that. Normal job attrition may simply mean shifting people around. But we do have to find ways to realign our existing resources so they more effectively match the state's needs and are serving the state in that way.
In regards to the tuition freeze, this is something you did advocate for, correct? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can talk about why it was important to freeze tuition for another year.
Well, I'll have a little fun with that, if I may, Maureen. Mm-hmm. As a student, I think it's important that we do what we can to hold costs down. I don't think tuition is high here. I think it's reasonable. However, if you were to tell that to a parent who has two children in higher education within the university, they would say, oh, my goodness, what is that president thinking? That's ridiculous. I understand that. For the average family, this is difficult. And we are a public university, and that's critically important. So I don't apologize for that at all. What I am worried about is finding ways to make sure that we're providing a quality education while we're doing that. And this, as the state has reduced its resources to the university over a year, every state's done that. There's declining state contribution. We've all concurrently raised our tuition amounts in order to offset that loss. And I think we have to be much more aggressive in looking at other sources and other ways of doing that.
And some universities have said that with the tuition freeze, that's put them in difficult positions when it comes to funding. And as you mentioned before, it can go along with faculty raises and just any other operating expenses at the university.
Yes, and part of this is the fund balance issue that the institution's system faces. Even though people don't understand that whole issue, it's really a cash balance. So at least 40% of that balance. I have a bill for, I have a purchase order, I have an invoice, something against that. And so in a normal accrual accounting system, that wouldn't be counted as cash at all or a balance at all. It's a bill that's due. And then there's another 20% of that that's committed for replacing a roof or fixing this or fixing that. Could we reallocate that? Yes. But the fund, so we really don't have that much money in reserves truly available. However, that there are some folks who believe we shouldn't have any. And part of the process is convincing people the volatility of year-to-year enrollment of even state aid, of things like that, requires that we mitigate against that with some level of reserves. so we can make adjustments because we can't do them quickly. The second part of your question is I think it's important that we resolve that in a way that people understand it and we clearly communicate what we have. But the second part of your comment was this varies by institution within the system. So there are several institutions that are making, in fact, most of them are making significant base cuts right now and have last year, and many more will be doing it this year. They do not have the reserves in order to shift them over to cover some of these cuts. Now, I would argue that we should be making some cuts. I'm not disputing that. What people don't realize is that we just can't make those cuts quickly. This is like a huge battleship. It's difficult to turn and takes a lot of energy. But we are making those, and we're trying to do it wisely, but it's not equal across the board.
While state funding has come down for the UW system, and as you said, this is going on in other states too, not just Wisconsin, is there any sense that that trend would be reversed and that maybe more money could be coming towards the UW system once again?
I think it's rather bleak, but that doesn't discourage me because I think there are lots of opportunities and great arguments for what we're putting forward. But let me try to put that in context a little bit. First of all, the state has actually increased the actual dollars to the university, but the percentage of the state's budget that is dedicated to higher education or distributed to higher education has gone down. And that's in part because of all the other competitive things seeking those funds. Medicaid at this point is about 17 or 18% of the state's budget. In another, 8 to 10 years, it'll be 30 to 35%. So as their demands grow, the amount of money necessary to maintain and build roads, that K-12's portion of the budget is growing. We get squeezed because we're within that discretionary amount. We're not mandatory kinds of funding. So we have to make the case in a very clear way that connects what we do to what the state needs to do. The second part of that challenge is that we think in long-term time periods, higher education is, a four-year kind of cycle. We're thinking 10 to 20 years out what the state needs. The state thinks in short term. Something's got to be fixed now. It's a short-term mentality. How do we reconcile both of those? I would argue that it's on the backs of the university, to use a horrible idiom here, it's on the backs of the university that the state's future rests. We need to be doing things well. I agree, and we all may differ about how best to do that. But if the university is doing well, the state will do well. And I think that's an argument I would enjoy having that conversation with legislators throughout the state. I believe every one of them agree with that. There's not a one, regardless of party. I think, though, they may differ about how to do that. And that's a fair conversation.
As the top advocate for the UW system, I am curious about your relationship with legislators because, as I had heard from some people back in the springtime, there was this sense that maybe you could close the gap and maybe help bridge that relationship between the university system and legislators more. Do you feel like that is something you've at least been working on, or is that something you want to work on more?
Well, part of the process is it's just relationship building. Do they know you? Do you know them? Do you care about them, and do they care about you? That's just good human relations. I would argue that relationships are, I would think, better. I think they have been told that. But a lot of this is a result of legislators reaching out to me and reaching out to the university. They want the university to do well. They may differ with us about how best to do that, and they don't mind telling us. But they want us to be successful. You can just feel that when they and part of the reason they're frustrated is they feel like we could be doing better. Now, having said all that, I think the relationship only gets you in the door. It only allows you to have the conversation, as it should, because you want legislators to be critical, to be examining things, to be careful, to scrutinize us carefully. We want that. And as a taxpayer, I want them to do that. So I think that's really important. Do your job. Hold us accountable and scrutinize us carefully. And I hope we receive that well. We should. That's their job, and we want them to do that.
UW System President Ray Cross traveled to La Crosse recently to visit the UWL campus and meet with business leaders. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up, a discussion about animal welfare and autism with Dr. Temple Grandin. She's been a leader in both, designing humane livestock practices while having Asperger's syndrome. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. A revolutionary when it comes to animal welfare, Dr. Temple Grandin has helped transform the livestock industry by encouraging more humane practices on ranches, farms, and at slaughter facilities. A professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University, Dr. Grandin has said that much of her life's work and outlook is influenced by being autistic. Dr. Temple Grandin spoke on the UW La Crosse campus recently. She joins me in the studio along with WISM reporter Brad Williams. Dr. Grandin, I'm wondering if you can just first talk about if you remember that point in your life when you decided, I want to work for animal welfare. I want to really make this a part of my life's work.
Well, a lot of things you kind of gradually get into. I get asked all the time, well, how did you even get interested in cattle in the first place? Because I got exposed to them when I was a teenager. Students get interested in things they get exposed to. And one of the things that helped me in working with animals is I'm an extreme visual thinker. So one of the first things I started doing was looking at what were cattle seeing when they were going through the chutes? Sunbeams, shadows, vehicles parked next to chutes. I mean, people hadn't thought about looking at that. And then some of my later work, which I think really made a difference, was developing an objective scoring system for slaughter plants. Instead of saying, well, this place is good or bad, how do we measure it? Kind of like traffic rules. You know, if you have more than three cattle mooing and bellowing in the stun box area, then the plant fails the audit. It's very, very simple outcome-based measurements.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit more about just the different practices that you really did revolutionize.
Well, when I was young, back in the 70s, I thought if I built the right equipment, I could fix everything. You know, equipment's only part of the equation. The other part of the equation is the management. And the older I get, the more and more I want to emphasize the management. And that's why I'm interested in things like the subjective scoring system. Because then you can measure, is your cattle handling getting better or your pig handling getting better or is it getting worse? Because you manage things that you measure. And I discuss this measurement system in a book I have called Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach. Also in another book I got, Animals Make Us Human.
And, you know, some people may say, well, the livestock or the pigs, they're heading to the slaughterhouse. What difference does it make?
Well, they feel pain. They feel fear. And that's one of the reasons why we should not be doing things to them that are bad. What's very important, give that animal a life worth living. And sometimes people have said to me, well, how can you care about animals but be involved in sending them to the slaughterhouse? Well, I kind of figured out back in the early 90s when I worked on a big piece of equipment with one of the large plants, looked out over all these cattle out in the stockyards, and I thought they would have never have been born. But we've got to give them a life worth living. And one of my biggest concerns right now is what I call biological system overload. You know, the dairy cow, we're pushing her for more and more and more and more production. Lameness in dairy cows, problems with sore feet, is at high levels, like 25%. There's a point where we need to start thinking about what's optimal, not what is maximum.
So you do look at other industries beyond maybe the beef industry or the hog industry. You do work within the dairy industry too.
Yeah, I've done some stuff with the dairy industry. And what I found with the meat plants, they've actually gotten quite good now because they've had companies like McDonald's audited them. Also, the USDA has gotten a whole lot more strict. But some of the problems I'm seeing now, I'm going to have to fix at the farm. Half-dead, really skinny dairy cows. Let's market them before they get to that point. Really wild cattle that see their first man on foot when they get to a plant. See, an animal is a visual thinker, so the man on foot is a different picture than the man on the horse. They need to get trained to both. And this is mainly a problem out west, not a problem here. You can get pigs where they've never had a person walk through them in their pen. And if the first time a person walks in their pen on shipping day, the pigs are going to be screeching and going crazy. They need to get trained to people walking through them long before it's time to go to the meat plant. Also, let's look at some meat quality issues. That last 5 minutes, you can wreck pork.
Electric really?
Prods, getting them screaming and excited. Last 5 minutes, you're going to get more pale, soft, watery meat. Cattle, electric prods, excitement. Last 5 minutes, tougher meat.
So when you mention something like in the dairy industry, how sometimes you'll come across a farm and there may be a cow who's way too skinny or maybe they're on their feet too much. When you experience something like that, do you generally work with the individual farmer or is this something that you say, how can we change this? Because I'm sure this is going on at other farms.
Well, one of the problems we're getting with the dairy cow, I think we're just pushing that biology too hard. You know, the dairy cow is putting so much into her meat, her milk, that there's nothing left of the cow. They're losing all the fat in their body, all the fat in their feet. And interestingly, as I travel around the world, the British dairy industry and the dairies in China, I was in China in June, are going with the Australian and the New Zealand Holstein because their feedstuffs are extremely expensive. They don't produce as much milk, but they also don't eat as much.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Temple Grandin, an animal rights and autism advocacy leader. She's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. Our next question comes from WISM's Brad Williams.
When you make such suggestions as to how to change the breeding of the cattle and the raising or any of the other animals, are your ideas accepted readily by the farmer or by the corporation, or does it take a bit of urging and saying, well, experiment with it a little bit and see if you don't get better results?
Well, I found that selling people the magic new piece of equipment, that's easy. People will always buy the thing before they will do the management. But I've been somebody in the industry to kind of see problems before they come. Like there's been problems with feeding too many beta agonists and getting lame cattle. And I was one of the first people to see that problem. And they'll go, oh, well, it's just anecdotal. But then there's a point where I'm seeing problems in enough different places that it's no longer anecdotal. You might ask, what brings about change? Okay, the equipment, that's easy. But how about just rough handling? The thing that stopped it in the meatpacking plants is when McDonald's and Wendy's, this was back in 1999, started auditing plants, and they threw a few plants off the approved supplier list for, you know, being rough with cattle or with pigs. And when you got a big customer insisting on that, that makes change. Hate to say it, but that's the way it was. And then eventually you can kind of change the culture. But in the beginning, they had to be pushed to change.
In studying some of the other countries where food is produced, what sort of things might they be better off doing to try to decrease hunger, for example, and make sure some of these other countries are producing the food that they need?
Well, I read an article just the other day in one of the cattle magazines or livestock magazines about food waste. Don't hold me to these exact figures, but I was looking at things like wastes of different food just in people's homes, and it's something awful like certain foods with 20% of it was getting wasted. That's the first thing. We need to be cutting down on food waste. And I just got asked this morning about what I thought about the whole pink slime debacle. Well, if you stop using that finely textured meat, you know, a great big, huge, gigantic plant is going to throw away an entire truckload of live cattle every single day. Now, it should have been labeled. You don't want to be surprising consumers. But if we don't save that product, these great big plants do 5,000 head of cattle a day. it's you'd just be taking a semi-load of cattle to the dump and shooting them, and we shouldn't be wasting that food, but it does need to be on the label.
I want to steer to a different direction. You're, of course, also known because of your experience with autism, and there has been a good deal of progress made in understanding that condition over the years. But I also noticed that it seems to be at the point in America where people are getting a fear about it that it's going to be, it's one out of 100, it's one out of 50. Has the research into autism improved people's lives, or are we getting to the point where people are becoming unnecessarily afraid of having autism in the family?
Well, autism is a very big spectrum, yes. And there'd be no radio station here without some autism to invent things like radio stations. You see, a little bit of the trait gives an advantage. Too much of the trait, you get an extreme handicap. That's something we've learned in animal breeding, too. Too much of a little bit of a trait, good. Too much of a trait, you've got a problem that's really bad. And autism goes all the way from Einstein and half the people in Silicon Valley to somebody so handicapped they can't dress themselves. Now, I think some of the increase is increased detection. You know, kids that we used to just call geeks and nerds and things like that, now they're getting a mild autism, a diagnosis. And the other problem is social rules are not being taught in a strict way that they were taught in the 50s. In the 50s, if I put my elbows on the table, my mother would say, put your elbows on your lap. You were given the instruction.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Temple Grandin. She's an animal rights and autism advocacy leader, and she's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. I wanted to ask you a couple other questions about the farming industry and the livestock industry as well. You know, every now and then these videos surface of maybe a worker within a dairy plant or a livestock facility mistreating animals. I mean, would you say that those are representative of the industry? Are those mostly isolated incidences that do get blown up sometimes?
Well, I think a good way to put it is to say that people beating up dairy cows is representative. That'd be like saying that pictures of drunken driving accidents is representative of driving. But the thing that I'm seeing, unfortunately, the dairy industry has got more of these bad videos. The worst recent videos that are out there right now are dairy. Because the pig videos that have come out more recently, yeah, they might, you know, take a few too many pigs. They've flipped a few pigs over. But it's not showing the really bad stuff. Unfortunately, some of the worst stuff that's out there right now, it's some of the dairy stuff.
Will you ever reach a perfect state in the dairy industry, the livestock industry, the pork industry?
Nothing in the world can ever be made perfect. It's in the practical world. And I think one of the problems we've got today is you've got a lot of young people today that have never done hands-on things. There's no, the practical world is never going to be perfect. You can get it really good. But right, I'm sorry, a dairy industry, but you've got some problems. And I just want to let everybody know, I'm not a vegan. I eat lots of dairy products. I love ice cream. I had some for lunch, and meat and bacon and things like that. But we've got to do things right.
You mentioned kind of the effects that McDonald's had on different processing facilities being audited and whatnot. But what are some other more recent strides that the industry has taken that you think are a step in the right direction? And what more can be done?
Well, the slaughter plants, that's one of the areas where they've gotten a whole lot better. You know, I've been around since the 70s. And boy, I can remember the 80s and the early 90s. That's when the meat industry was really bad. They were just out of control. And then in the late 90s, McDonald's and Wendy's started enforcing things. I spend a lot of my time right now working on guidelines of big corporations, and I kind of use the approach sort of like traffic rules. Think about it. There's only about three things the police really need to enforce for safety. Okay, the drunken driving stuff, texting while driving, stopping violations, and speeding. Most of the other stuff doesn't matter that much. Okay, what are some of the most critical control points? First of all, you got to make sure there's not out-and-out abuse. But one really big thing on the farm is lameness, sore feet. The dairy industry's got a lot of problems with that. The swine industry had a lot of problems, and they've actually started to correct some of their problems with leg conformation.
Here in southwest Wisconsin, we have some of the highest concentrations of organic farms. You know, some are beef producers, yep. Some are dairy producers, poultry, whatnot.
Yeah.
But is the organic industry, is that anything you ever work with?
Yep, I've worked on organic things, too. And one of the biggest things, the organic standard makes it very clear that you cannot use antibiotics. But if you have a sick animal and you don't treat it, that'd be really, really bad for welfare. The organic standard makes it clear that that animal has to be treated and then taken off the program. But I've seen some people cheat on that, lice all over cattle, hair falling out. And then people get used to seeing that and say, well, it's normal in the spring for the hair fall out. No, it's not normal. And with the organic animals, you're going to need to use hardier animals. You see, if you just breed an animal for production, you tend to lose some of the immune function. There's always trade-offs in things. In fact, I write about this in a textbook I've done called Behavior and the Genetics of Domestic Animals.
I mean, is there a way, and maybe are there people who are working on finding that happy medium within the organic meat industry, especially when you talk about, you know, you're sacrificing your organic status for treating and making sure that the cow isn't sick?
Well, in anything, you got different people, you know, do better at things than other people. I've been over to Europe, you know, and I got a zillion regulations and things like that. But I think actually our slaughter plants are better than Europe. I've been reading some of the literature and I was reading a paper in one of the scientific journals about a plant in Italy. Their stress levels were so horrible, I couldn't believe it. Our plants, by using the numerical scoring, I'm not going to say they're perfect, but our federally inspected plants are doing better than a lot of places in Europe are doing.
I've read before that you say that you feel with your autism you're able to relate to animals in a way that's unique. Can you talk about that?
Animals are sensory-based thinkers. They don't think in language. And when you think in sensory, it's going to be pictures. You know, like, for example, animals can get fear memories. I met a horse that was terrified of black hats because during a veterinary procedure, somebody had thrown alcohol in his eyes and that person was wearing a black hat. White hats were okay. Black hats were bad. You see, that's animal thinking that's very specific. You want to understand animal behavior. You've got to get away from verbal language.
Before, when Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio had asked you just about autism, this reminded me of a quote I found of yours that I just found really touching. You had said, the world needs all kind of minds. I love that.
Well, let me give you an example. And I'm going to be talking about that in many of the talks that I've done. I'm a visual thinker. Now, there's another kind of mind that's a mathematical thinker. They think in patterns. So you need to have the visual thinker and the engineers working together. Steve Jobs was an artist. So an artist invented the interface on the iPhone, and then the engineers had to make it work. Also, all you people that want everybody to learn algebra, now it screens out a lot of visual thinkers. You need us visual thinkers because you need us to prevent accidents like the Fukushima nuclear power plant. When I found out why those reactors melted down, I'm going, how could you do that? How could you put all your emergency equipment in a non-waterproof basement? If they'd had some very simple crank-em-shut submarine doors, it would not have happened.
I do want to talk a bit more about education, and I'm just going to throw in some numbers here. According to the Autism Society, obviously autism is on the rise, and as you said, maybe it's because there's more detection, maybe
especially more. On the very, very mild, what okay. I would call geeks and nerds, because I've been out to Silicon Valley. I've been all the many of the major tech companies, and you've got cubicle after cubicle of programmers there that are on the spectrum. And then the human resources people say, oh, we know they're on the spectrum. We don't talk about it. That was what one human resources person at a major company told me last year in 2013.
Wow. So in the year 2000, the Autism Society says that 1 in 150 children were born with autism. In the year 2010, that number jumped to 1 in 68 births. And as you said, you know, people are talking about it more. Maybe human resources people are not talking about it more.
They're out in Silicon Valley. They end up working in the tech industry, and they're not
sure.
Very social. But I think some of it is, in my generation, social rules were taught in a much more rigid way. Kids were taught how to shake hands. They were taught how to have table manners. So if you're a little socially awkward, you actually did better. So some of that increase, I think, is increased detection, especially on the real mild end. I think there is some severe stuff that's been increasing, you know. And also get out in the tech community and you take two programmers or two radio station engineers and they get married. You're concentrating that genetics. It's a continuous trait, thousands of little tiny snips in the DNA, and and then you're more likely to get a kid that remains nonverbal.
So, you mentioned that, certain HR people are saying, yes, we know that our workers maybe are on the autism spectrum, but we don't talk about it. I am curious about that. When it comes to adults living with autism, maybe people who have severe cases that...
The problem you got is there's a big difference between dealing with just a geeky, nerdy kid. You got to teach them some social skills, teach them some work skills. Boy, I wish paper routes were still around. I'd put every single one of these 12-year-olds on a paper route.
And we autism need or not?
All of them. Kids have got to learn work skills. When I was 13, I had a little sewing job. And when I was 15, I cleaned 8 horse stalls every day. And it's a discipline and a responsibility for working. And I think all kids need to learn that.
Do you think the education system currently is, just because more people are more aware of autism, do you think school districts are really handling students with autism in ways possible? Obviously,
I'm
every school district.
I'm not going to make a generalization about school districts. I travel around to a whole lot of different places, and I find so much depends upon the particular place, the particular school. I'm seeing some situations with great outcomes, other situations with bad outcomes. And one of the big problems I'm seeing is too much overprotecting of these kids. You got to stretch these kids. When I was a little kid, I had to be party hostess at my mother's parties. And my brother had to do it, too. It helped him to get a job as a big bank vice president. So it wasn't just the autistic kid that had to do it. But you got to stretch these kids. You got to take them just outside the comfort zone. I'm seeing too many kids that don't know how to shake hands, do not know how to shop. They don't. The parents do all the talking for them. We got to have a little less helicopter parents.
So what is working? What do you think are the best programs in schools that work for students who have autism?
Well, I'm going to just talk about things we need to do. Okay, if you got a 3-year-old that's not talking, I don't care what the diagnosis is. I really don't care because the treatment's the same. Your 3-year-old's not talking. Okay, make sure there isn't something physically wrong with the throat. Okay, you rule out those kind of problems. You need to have a teacher teach them nursery rhymes, teach them words, teach them turn-taking. You got to teach these kids turn-taking. The worst thing you can do is let them sit in the corner rocking and tuning out. And then when they're getting to elementary school, build on strengths. My ability in art was always encouraged. And ability in art became the basis of a design career. So build on the strength. You got a 3rd grader that's good in math, let him have the high school math book. Don't hold him back. Get him online and learn some computer programming. We have got to control the video game playing. I'm hearing way too much. He's 21, I can't get him out of the basement. I'm hearing way too much of that. They're ending up on Social Security. Teenagers have got to learn work skills. Got to. Also, when they get bullied and teased in school, let's get them into activities where there's a shared interest. Because the only places where I was not bullied and teased was electronics lab and horseback riding, where I was in with other students with shared interests. That's another really important thing. And then out in the work world, learn to sell your work rather than yourself. Put together a portfolio of your work. So I'd go to interview a plant or interview a ranch, and I just laid out my drawings, and that's how I sold jobs.
Your work speaks for itself.
That's right. That's what I did.
Do you feel like workplaces have to do more to work with adults with autism? As you said, in Silicon Valley, maybe there are plenty of places. But...
Well, the main thing in the workplace is you cannot be subtle. There's a scene in the HBO movie about me where my boss slams down the deodorant and says, "You stink, use it." And his secretaries took me out shopping for better clothes.
Was that real?
That's real. That is real. And I was very angry at the time, but now I thank that boss. So maybe I'm a little bit eccentric. In the workplace, if the person's, let's say you want to train somebody to be a museum tour guide. A lot of museums will take them as young as 12. Great job. Somebody's got to demonstrate the correct distance you stand, how to approach a client. You don't just follow them around and stalk them. So you might say, watch how Susie does it, and I want you to copy how Susie does it. Or if it's, let's say it's a programming job, you don't just say to them, well, develop new software. That's too vague. You might say, I want a phone app that does some specific thing. It's got to work on this platform, use this programming language where there's a specific outcome. It can only use a certain amount of memory. It's got to do some specific thing. And it can be a really hard thing, but be specific, not vague.
Well, Dr. Grandin, is there anything else that you want to talk about or any final thoughts you have for listeners?
Well, we've got to develop kids' strengths. Build up the thing they're good at. And the other thing, put your portfolio on your phone. Because another thing I learned is you never know where you're going to find the person that can open the door. He might be sitting next to him on the bus. Maybe it's some techie guy that's got a techie company ID hanging around his neck. You whip that phone out, show him some programming you've got on it, and you've got a job. Lots of times people just don't see where the door to opportunity is. It's right there, but they don't see it.
Dr. Temple Grandin has been a leader in helping institute humane animal treatment practices in the livestock industry. She's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. She's also an advocate for people with autism. She lives with a high-functioning form of autism known as Asperger's syndrome. We'd also like to thank Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio for helping to ask questions during Dr. Grandin's recent visit to UW-La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.